Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Froster, and joining me today is editor Simon Lambert. And coming up, saving rates are finally on the up. But with inflation at 7% and rising, is there any point bothering? Simon says it's time to ditch your insult account, and we give you some ideas on the best and cheapest way to invest 100 quid a month. Also today, heating or eating, Netflix or Disney Plus, how people are cutting back in this cost of living crisis, and the monthly printer ink deals from HP that come with a very big catch. Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
eToro is a social network.
No, eToro is an investment platform.
Fly me to the moon.
It's both. That's social investing. In other words, it's where millions of people invest in stocks, share ideas, strategies, and beyond. eToro, the power of social investing.
In other words,
download eToro today from the App Store or Google Play. Your capital is at risk.
But first, not everything that is going up at the moment is bad. Better news for savers as one-year fixed deals hit the highest levels seen for 3 years. Those prepared to lock their cash away for 12 months can now secure a rate more than three times what you could have got last year. But, and there's always a but, with inflation at 7% and expected to keep on rising, your savings pot is being eroded. So is there any point anymore? Firstly, Simon, welcome. Why rates going up?
Savings rates going up because interest rates going up. And that's connected to the fact that inflation is also going up. Inflation, 7%. That's pretty spicy. That's, in fact, the spiciest bit of inflation that we've seen for 30 years. And it's going to get spicier still, unfortunately. The good news, though, is that at least saving rates are on the rise. Banks are a bit keener to get people's money in. They've been lifting rates as interest rates go up. And it's a time to be picky, though. I mean, to be honest, it's been a time to be picky for ages, hasn't it? This is not the time to stick with your big bank. We're going to talk about that a bit later on. To stick with your big bank or building society or other form of bank, might be a small bank or small building society's legacy account that's paying you nothing. You need to get out there, have a look at the savings tables, go to thisismoney.co.uk/save to find our independent best buy tables and pick out the best deals in there and get your money into them. The good news is, as you said, 1 year fixed rate savings have reached the heady height of more than 2%. The best one from Al Rayan Bank pays 2.11%. And then you've got a clutch of challenges underneath it. Charter Savings Bank, Close Brothers Savings, Investec, Kent Reliance, Oxbury Bank, all paying 2.05%. And below that, you've got Synergy Bank and Gatehouse Bank paying 2%. Now, that's pretty decent compared to what you were being offered not so long ago. If you look at easy access accounts, you can bag yourself a 1.2% rate from either Synergy Bank or from Zopa, Smart Saver, or you can get a 1% rate with that old This Is Money favourite, Marcus. You can get 1.1% with Tandem as well, 1.05% with Principality, and Saga also does a 1% as well. It's not the kind of rates that are setting the world on fire. These are not the kind of thing that we're going to get massively excited about. But compared to where they were, when you were only getting 0.5% in your easy access account, when you were getting only 1% and a bit on your 1 year fix, this is a move in the right direction. This is good news. This is good news for savers.
I guess these are sort of rates now where you're looking at it, and you'll be talking about this in a minute, talking about your insult accounts, where it's really worth making that move. But before we get to that, inflation. Give us a bit of an economics 101. We hear this a lot about cash eroding in value because of inflation. Just explain to us what that's about.
Well, what really matters is not the nominal rate that you're being paid on your savings account. It's the real return that you're getting. And that's the return after inflation. Inflation is effectively the rise in the cost of living. Okay, it's a relatively simple concept for people to get their head around. It's how much more expensive is my life getting on an annual basis? And then is my money growing at a rate that is either outpacing that
Woohoo!
I'm getting wealthier. Keeping pace with it. Okay, I'm treading water, but that's not bad. Or falling behind it. Uh-oh, I'm getting poorer. For most people at the moment, it's the uh-oh, I'm getting poorer moment, because 7% inflation is really quite hard to beat in terms of returns. Even if you are investing purely in the stock market, I do not think that you should be expecting a 7% a year return. You might get a 7% a year return. You might get a much better than 7% a year return, but expecting it and getting it are two different things. And expecting it can lead you to perhaps take more risk than you should do. On cash, unfortunately, due to the topsy-turvy world that we live in, where after the financial crisis, interest rates dropped like a stone and started to fall regularly below inflation rather than above inflation. And there have been times when interest rates have been above inflation, but that's only because inflation has been so low. Then in most cases, people have been making a negative real return on their cash. What's the negative real return on your cash? You ask me, say, Lambert, what is this jargon you're talking about? You're losing money. That's what it amounts to. You're losing money. And that's only if you go on the official rate of inflation, which is 7%. I mean, everybody has a different rate of inflation, really. It depends what you spend your money on. That basket of goods might not reflect your spending. There are some people who, in terms of falling into a category, are typically harder hit by inflation and suffer a greater overall rate of inflation than others. And unfortunately, they tend to be the people who have less money. So those at the lower end of the income scale and pensioners. Everybody else falls somewhere in between. It might be that you could be perfectly wealthy and on a very decent income, and you could have an inflation rate that's well below that official rate of inflation because you spend your money on stuff that's not going up in price so much, and you're quite cautious about your savings. And it is possible to bring your own personal rate of inflation down by spending less money or swapping out for cheaper stuff, really tracking down those discounts. Now, the difficulty is if you've been doing that to the absolute maximum, where do you go after that? And I think there's definitely some people finding that at the moment. But one of the great problems, of course, that we're facing right now is that a lot of inflation is being driven by essentials. It's being driven by energy bills, food, the cost of getting around, i.e. Petrol, trains as well, as we were talking about last week. And that is causing people a headache, and meaning that for many people, the rate of return they are going to get on their savings is going to fall below inflation. And we're not talking about investing here. We can talk about investing later. We are talking about money in the bank, cash savings, which, let's face it, is the thing that dominates. It's what most people do, at least first of all, with their money. We encourage people to invest all the time for better returns, but at the end of the day, loads of people have got loads of money sitting in cash. I had the question asked to me the other day by someone I know very well. They run their own business, so they just build up money within their account. Mm-hmm. They said to me, I've got £80,000 sitting in my bank account and it's earning 0.1% interest. I think I should probably do something else with it. What can I do with it? And that money is, there's tax there being rolled up to pay tax bills. There's cash funds for the business, not that needs to be drawn on because it's a sole trader, not a limited company. And there's the kind of the reserve, there's the rainy day money. There's all that stuff meshed into that pot. And there's the profit that they've made, you know, because they're self-employed, they're not paying themselves a salary, it's rolling up. But that's a lot of money to have sitting in an account paying you 0.1%.
What did you advise?
Oh, I sent them a link to my column this week about insult accounts and getting the hell out of them. And a link to the This Is Money savings tables. And I said, at the first instance, put your money into one of these accounts that's paying you at least a better rate of return. Because if you've got 80,000, this is way out of line with how much money most people have in an account, okay? But if you've got £80,000 in an account earning 0.1% interest, you are getting £80 a year. If you have £80,000 in an account paying 1% interest, you are getting £800 a year. You are not keeping pace with inflation with either of those rates. You will lose money, but you are getting £720 more. And yeah, that's quite a big difference.
Yeah, exactly.
Isn't it? I mean, that's, you know, yeah, I don't really need to go any further on. That's a big difference, £720. And if you know, the difference between finding a 2% account and a 1% account, all of a sudden it's £1,600. Now, I wouldn't necessarily lock your money away in a one-year savings account if you're going to need to get it. I definitely wouldn't within the year. But even then, I'd be careful about locking all my money in there, because you know what? Maybe those rates could be 2.5% soon. They could be going higher. But you do need to slice your money up and get it in there. And even if you just get it into the best instant access savings account rather than that 0.1% paying account that you've just got it sitting in, or loads of people just leave loads of money sitting in their current account earning nothing, you are at least doing something with it. And as the supermarket once said, every little helps.
Indeed. All right, then, I'm going to pretend right now, Simon, that this is the audio podcast version of clicking on my WhatsApp and the link that you've just sent me to your article telling me to ditch my insult account. Alas, I'm not the person with an £80,000 in their bank account. However, I'm sure a lot of us do have their money in these ridiculously insulting accounts. So, Simon, I'm clicking on it. What does it say?
Okay, so it tells you, of all the things I just told you about inflation and cash savings and savings rates going up, then it says, so what should you do? It's tempting, as you said, to just throw your hands up and say, well, what's the point? Inflation is so high and so much higher than interest rates on savings accounts that I might as well just give up and do nothing. But do you really want to let a bank have your £720 that you could have? Is that what you want to do? Obviously, it's not £720 because most people don't have the £80,000. But you know what I mean? Why are you leaving the money on the table for the bank to take? The bank doesn't need your money. The building society doesn't need your money. I tell you what, the person in charge of that bank or building society is being paid hundreds of thousands of pounds a year, at least. Some of them are being paid millions. Don't give them your money. Put it into a better savings account. Okay. So if you've got a 2% one-year fix, you've got 7% inflation, you're losing 5%. If you've got a 1% easy access savings account, you've got 7% inflation, you're losing 6%. Now, nobody wants to do that, okay? But don't just leave it sitting in your bank or building society's insult account. What's an insult account, I hear you ask? An insult account is what I call the legacy savings accounts. Or even they're not, some of them aren't even legacy savings accounts. Some of them are just savings accounts they still offer to new customers that banks and building societies have that pay you such a pitiful rate of interest that giving you that interest rate is an insult. It would be better to be paid no interest at all. I am talking to the banks and building societies out there who have been paying 0.01% interest on some of their accounts, or 0.1% interest now, but hey, what's 0.09% between friends? Get out of those accounts. I'm going to be honest here. I've got some money probably sitting in some of those accounts that shouldn't be there. And it's easy because it's because I've opened that account with my bank and I've just gone, oh, I'll get that money out of my current account because I don't want to accidentally spend it. I'll shove it in that savings account because then it's in a different place. Okay, so I've achieved something in terms of behavioral finance. I've moved the money from a different place, both mentally and physically, so I can't spend it. But that's not the time to sit back and slap yourself on the back.
No.
The time to sit back and slap yourself on the back is when you've moved it into the savings account that's paying you the best rate. And yeah. I published my column today, and you know what? Nationwide Building Society raised its savings rates.
Oh, good.
And announced it was doing it today. Now, some rates, a couple of them, have gone up to as high as 0.4%.
Are you suggesting it's because of your article, Simon?
No, I'm not.
You're an influential man.
That was obviously pre-planned. It was just coincidence.
Yeah.
Serendipitous, whatever you want to call it, okay?
Either way.
Now, some of those rates, which a lot of them have some kind of limit on them as to when you can take your money out. These aren't fixed rates. These are, you know, limited, easy access, but with catches kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Some of them have gone up as high as 0.5%. I mean, there's a couple that have gone up by the full 0.25% that the base rate's gone up. The mortgage rate, of course, has gone up by the full 0.25% that the base rate's gone up. Elsewhere, though, Nationwide, which never let us forget is on your side, continues to offer pitiful rates. One savings account that it offers is seeing its rate rise to 0.11%.
Oh,
now, to be fair to Nationwide, it's going up from 0.01%.
Yeah.
And this 0.1% rise to the accounts will apply to the Instant Access Saver, Instant ISA Saver, and Cash Builder accounts, and it will move them up to 0.11%, 0.13%, or 0.15%, depending on the balance. So the more you've got in there, the higher the rate you'll get. To which I would say, podcast listeners, I leave it up to you. Are Nationwide's accounts paying 0.11% to 0.15% insult accounts or not? You make your mind up. But I'd get my money out of them if I was in them. And you know what? Really, I've probably got some money in one of them, so I should probably go take the money out of it.
You've got to be careful, Simon, because last time we mentioned about the fact that we had some money in our 0.01 counts, we got a bit of stick for it, didn't we, for some listeners? Nobody's do as we say.
Not as we do. Nobody's perfect. Yeah.
So, Simon, then apart from the 3 to 6 months emergency savings that us personal finance journalists bang on about all the time in easy access, but when the boiler breaks or you smash your teeth or whatever, investing is the only way forward. Is that what we're saying? Does it naturally leap to that conclusion?
I don't think it's the only way forward.
Right. Buy yourself a really great holiday or something, or spank all the money. No, it's another option.
Oh, spending the money is definitely an option.
Yeah.
I think that if you want a better rate of return, then you are going to have to take a bit of risk and you're going to have to invest. Investing in the stock market is really what we're talking about here. You could choose something which invests some of your money in shares, some of your money in bonds. Okay, the traditional 60-40 portfolio would be 60% shares, 40% bonds. There's some questions over the wisdom of that traditional portfolio at the moment, because the 40% bond element largely consisted of very high quality grade government bonds, and that market has been hugely warped by the crazy monetary policy of the last decade or more. However, it's the shares element that's going to give you the growth, that's going to boost things, whether that's through share price rises or dividends earned. And I think that if you take the scenario where someone has considerably more than their rainy day pot that they need, the buffer zone that they require, then they should think about trying to invest some of that money for a better return. And if you're starting from the position where you're looking at it and going, oh, I've got quite a lot of money here and I really don't want to put it in, and then the stock market crash and I lose a big chunk of money, then maybe you think about drip feeding that money in. Or if you're saving regularly on a monthly basis, instead of saving regularly on a monthly basis and topping up your rainy day fund that's already in cash and earning very little by even more, you start saving regularly into an investment account and investing the money. And you can dabble. You don't have to put all of your money in. You know, say you've got the chunk of money above your rainy day pot, and you look at that and you think, do I really want to invest all of that in one go? You can go, okay, I'll tell you what, I'm just going to invest 20% of it or 30% of it, and I'll see how that goes. And once I'm comfortable with that, and if it, then maybe I'll think about investing some more. I'll ease myself into it. It's not an all or nothing game. And you might get unlucky. You might look at it over a calendar year or a tax year or whatever period you want to look at, over a year type period, for example, and you end up down. But those years are rare. They are few and far between. There's plenty of them, but they're not the majority of years. In most years, you'll end up up. If you look at the FTSE All Share, for example, which is the broad UK stock market, the dividend yield on that, which is the payouts that companies give you for holding their shares, on average, that dividend yield on the All Share is just above 3%. Okay, so you're going to get paid 3% just for holding the shares, and then you're going to get any share price growth you get on top of that as well. I think realistically, a 5% a year return is a kind of fair enough assumption that you're going to get. Anything above that, that's great. Mm-hmm. Anything below that, you just have to chalk up the bad years with the good. And over the long term, investing in the stock market has proven to be the best way of growing your wealth and beating inflation. And there are reams and reams and reams of studies that show that. And the reason is because you're basically putting your money into companies that take your money and they put it to productive use to make profits. And then those profits either lead to their share price going up because people go, that's a good company, it's making money. Or they give some of that money back to shareholders in the form of dividends. If you start trying to pick individual shares and beat the market, you run the risk that you get it wrong and you don't beat the market, which is the argument for passive investing and just buying the market. But if you only buy the market, you can't beat the market either. So fund managers will tell you, well, go with us, we'll get it right, we've got the expertise, the knowledge, the professionalism to beat the market. Do you believe them? Are they any good? Can they consistently do that? It's up to you to decide. But again, it's not an all or nothing affair. You can put some of your money into passive funds, really simple, cheap ones, like Vanguard's Life Strategy, which invests all around the world and gives you a selection of shares and bonds so you can dial down your risk. Or a really cheap global tracker fund. For example, lots of companies offer these. They're very easy to find. And you'll be investing all around the world in the world's best companies. And the great thing about that is you end up sticking with the winners, because the winners win and stay in there and get bigger, and the losers fall out. You can end up quite exposed to some very big name companies, especially at the moment, where you've got things like Apple that have a larger stock market capitalization than some countries that fund would hold. But you could just hold some of your portfolio in that, and then you could use some of the stuff on the other side to try to back some fund managers that you think are going to get it right. And there are funds and investment trusts out there that specialize in investing in lower risk stuff and aim for beating inflation and protecting your money, and then trying to make a return on top of it. Stuff like personal assets, Ruffer investment trust, and things like that. But I think if you want a better return on your money, yes, you probably are going to have to invest.
The thing about investing is it is so much easier now than it used to be. The entire landscape has changed. Our listeners are very engaged, and so of course they will be hanging on every word you say if they don't know it already, you see. But there's lots of people that would listen to that and think, oh my God, that sounds just too confusing. And very, you know, this has nothing to do with intellect or anything, it's about engagement, I think. But actually there are so many robo-advisors, they call them, these investing apps that you could use, or even with the big banks now, there's a big battle going on. It doesn't really feel like you're investing. You really just, you know, set up some money to go out every month, and Bob's your uncle, they do the work for you. And with any luck, you look into it, you know, every year or however long, every half a year, and it should have grown your money. So, I mean, this idea that investing is this supremely complex thing, I mean, if you really, really want to get into the nitty gritty, yeah, absolutely. And you, all power to you. But for other people that say, oh, I don't invest, it doesn't have to be that confusing.
No, I would agree with you. And I would also say that, as somebody who spends a lot of time looking at the investment platform industry and following it, and, you know, is kind of deeply involved in the stuff that's going on there and the new stuff that's coming out, almost all of the money going into investment platforms and their services over the past 5 years, at least I would say, has gone on making it easier and simpler for people to invest, and has largely been targeted at those novice investors, people who want to start investing or are dabbling a bit and want to then learn how to do it a bit more. There's loads more places to do it, and a lot of them have launched on ease of use, helping people to do it, giving them a helping hand. And then you've got the existing platforms, the big guns, the Hargreaves Lansdowns, the Interactive Investors, the AJ Bells, the Fidelities, and so on, Charles Stanley's, who've put loads of effort into making their services very easy to use online, maybe on an app, holding your hand and helping you find stuff to invest in and not have to get to the point where you open an account and go, oh no, now I've got to pick 15 to 20 shares. How do I do that? Or what are all these funds? How do I choose one? Help, I'm going to stop. And do you know why they've done that? The reason is because they want your money. They're not stupid. They're very successful businesses that have very healthy profit margins. And they want people to put money in. They want to grow their customer base. They want their existing customers to put more money in. And they want more new customers to come in through the door. And the best way of doing that is making it as easy as possible and getting past those pinch points where people suddenly found it too hard and walked away. Now, I know for a fact from talking to lots of investment platforms over the years that the big problem they have is they can attract a new customer, they open an account, then they go into the account, and they have, so comes the time to pick the investments. And they go, I don't know what to do. And it's not necessarily the concern over I want to pick the absolute best and right investments. It's that I don't want to pick the bad ones that gets people. And so there's loads of work that's been done on that to try and help people. So if you look at, you've got those established ones that help people out, and then you've got a whole breed of new ones as well. And it is very, very simple, very easy to get started.
Just a quick one before we leave this. Because there are so many out there to choose from, and all brilliant, lots of them are brilliant. How do you choose the right one? Which one do you pick?
Do be careful. Don't just go for the one that you just saw on the tube or someone told you about. Check them out, obviously. Make sure your money's safe. Make sure that they're FCA registered. You've got the FSCS protection in case of malpractice and that kind of stuff. Read our guide, or thisismoney.co.uk/platforms, which is our roundup and review of the biggest investment platforms. And then think about how they might fit with your attitude to investing. So there's a new one that launched this week. AJ Bell, which is an established player, has launched Doddle. Doddle is a sort of stripped back investing service that offers less investments, very easy to use. It's got a friendly monster involved and it's got low costs. So it's got an annual charge of 0.15%. You've got Free Trade, which is very, very popular with people and has been picking up lots and lots of customers. You can buy shares, you can buy ETFs, you can buy investment trusts, but you can't buy funds with it. Then you've got some others that do other stuff. There's one called Wombat that we've looked at this week, and another one called Invest Engine. Invest Engine specializes in ETFs. Vanguard, major US player that came over here, set up a very cheap investment platform and only offers its own funds within there, but it has a lot of funds and has attracted a lot of people, and it's a good, easy place to do it. HSBC is going after its own customers and other people's customers. It's advertising its investment service at the moment. And Barclays Smart Investor has been pushing its service too. But as I said, go to thisismoney.co.uk/platforms and also to our DIY investing channel, and you'll find loads more information and be able to try to work out which one might be the right one for you.
Thank you very much, Simon. That's it for part one.
And now I'm joined by Sam North for our weekly look at what's been going on in the markets and what's likely to be coming up next week. Sam, welcome to the show.
Hi, Simon. Good to be here.
So it's been another busy week, hasn't it? What's been going on the markets this week, and not just stories involving Elon Musk?
Yeah, it's been a crazy one. I mean, listen, Elon Musk is right up there, but it's been fascinating, really, from sort of 2:30 on Friday to Tuesday evening. The stock market had a massive move lower, and actually, year to date, it was one of the worst it's been performances of the year of ever, since 30, 40 years, which is incredible. Mixture of COVID headlines from China, markets pricing in more interest rate rises, that didn't help. I mean, overall, earnings on the whole have actually been okay. There's been some poor performers as well, but overall not too bad. US GDP came out on Thursday, which at first glance was actually pretty disappointing, with the economy contracting in quarter one while inflation, as we know, is at a 40-year high. This is just going to spur on those stagflation fears and then potentially recession. It's been an interesting week.
And what do we have to look forward to next week?
Yeah, another busy one. It's all going to be about the Fed. The US Central Bank, we're expecting a 50 basis point interest rate rise. But really, we're going to focus on their comments about the economy and future expectations will be super critical. To make next week even more interesting, we also have the latest jobs numbers out of the United States. We've got interest rate decisions from the Bank of England as well, and the Reserve Bank of Australia, and also some earnings from Alibaba, from Shell, from Volkswagen, Airbnb and Pfizer. So yeah, it's a big, big week ahead, but also worth noting in the UK, bank holiday on Monday. So a shortened week for those based here.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that, Sam. We will speak to you next week.
Awesome. Thanks, Simon.
Welcome back. The cost of living crisis isn't going anywhere anytime soon. Around 90% of adults reported an increase in how much they're having to fork out last month, according to the latest official figures. We're having to make tough choices about our money in order to cope, some cutting back on essentials, dipping into our savings, and borrowing more. Simon, the picture doesn't look good. Sadly, the worst is yet to come, I fear.
It is, because these figures reflect what people were doing before their energy bills jumped with the price cap going up. It's a pretty miserable picture. It shows a nation who were finding that the cost of lots of stuff is going up. They're feeling it to the point where they've decided that they need to cut back. And they've started to cut back in various places. Nearly a quarter of people said they were struggling to pay their bills, household bills, last month, according to the latest ONS survey. And the Resolution Foundation put out some research this week that showed the proportion of people experiencing an increase in living costs reporting taking the following actions to cope with it. And this is from the 16th to the 27th of March. So 54% said, I'm spending less on non-essentials. 45% said, I'm using less fuel, such as gas or electricity. 39%, I'm reducing non-essential journeys in my vehicle. 37%, I'm shopping around more. 33%, I'm spending less on food, shopping and essentials. 23%, I'm using my savings. 12% have said none of these. So there you go. 88% of people are doing something. Unfortunately, you start to get down at the lower end to the people who really are struggling to make ends meet. 11%, I'm using credit more than usual. 7%, I'm borrowing money from friends or family. 5%, I'm working more hours than usual. And then you've got 1% using food banks more or starting to use food banks. And those are the people who were really struggling. But even the people who are wealthier on higher incomes are starting to cut back. And obviously, the problem is that then has an economic impact. It becomes a recessionary force, potentially. If enough people stop spending money on stuff in order to cut back because they're worried about inflation, then you will start to see growth in the economy slow dramatically because people are spending much less. Businesses are cutting back as well, it should be noted, because businesses are also seeing costs go up. And in fact, some businesses are seeing costs go up by much, much more than consumers. Mm. Business inflation is quite high because businesses don't benefit from the energy price cap. Businesses might be paying for stuff to be transported with the cost of fuel going up substantially. Businesses are having to pay their staff higher wages. Depending on what businesses they are and what industry they're in, they're having to pay much higher wages. I was talking to someone the other day who I know very well, who is an executive chef in a restaurant in London. They are having to pay their junior chefs a lot of money at the moment to get them in the door, because otherwise they just won't come and somebody else will take them. And that's something being experienced in a lot of other industries. And that all adds up to extra pressure that then businesses push through onto consumers with higher prices. And you get into this vicious circle.
One of the things there's lots of things that are very worrying about this, but I was talking earlier this week about the increase in borrowing and particularly buy now, pay later. And I'm not sort of jumping on the let's have a go at buy now, pay later. Many, many people do it. I think a third of UK adults now do it, which is incredible when you think this only really came up in 2016, I think Klarna started. But the worry is, like, I think the statistics were October last year. There was one in three borrowers who were struggling to make their payments. I mean, that was October. Things have changed quite dramatically since then. And these statistics that you're talking about were taken in March. So this is before, even as you said, energy price caps coming in, the national insurance rise, those sorts of things. Are we in danger of having another payday lending implosion? I mean, we saw after the financial crisis how that mushroomed and then, as I said, imploded. Are we likely to see something along the lines here?
I don't think so, if only because payday lending involved charging people exorbitant rates of interest, and that swiftly started to roll up if you weren't paying that money back. With buy now, pay later, of course, the difference is that there isn't really the interest element, unless you start missing payments, and then it might kick in. But the buy now, pay later trick is that effectively they're charging the retailer. It's the retailer paying because it boosts their sales. which does indicate that it will, if it boosts sales, it does indicate that it will encourage people to buy things they don't necessarily need. So at what point do you start to see that tail off? But then buy now, pay later has sort of blossomed, mushroomed, whatever you want to say, into being able to buy now, pay later, some really random and quite low cost items. And the problem with buy now, pay later is even if it doesn't involve incurring any interest, it does incur having to pay back that money at some point in the future.
Yeah.
And if you're buy now, pay latering something because you don't have enough money to pay for it out right now, and that's because you're feeling a bit short, well, then next month when you get paid, you might still be feeling a bit short if you're feeling a bit short because your bills have been going up. But then you've also got an extra bill to pay, which is your buy now, pay later bill. And so on and so on and so on. So you can see how it builds up. So I think it is an area to keep a very close eye on. And
I think it's how people are using it as well. I think there's increasing numbers of people using it to buy now, pay later on essentials, like food, for example. That's concerning.
Yeah, it is. It's very concerning. And that indicates, obviously, that they can't afford to pay for their essentials. So they're buy now, pay latering their essentials. And then again, as we said, it's a vicious circle, isn't it? Because next month you still won't be able to pay for your food shopping because you couldn't afford to pay for it this month, but you've got to pay for last month's food shopping as well.
Just really briefly on this one, the proposals, the measures that were mooted midweek by the Chancellor, Boris Johnson and MPs, etc. It sounded like they were all sitting around a table and just went, right, everyone, give us your best shot. And some of them are just, I mean, MOTs. Look, I'm no car expert, but I sort of have an idea that if you delay by 1 year checking your car out, any little small thing you might have is going to be a lot worse in a year's time and may cause you a lot more problems. And also things like increasing the number of kids that childminders can look after. I mean, are we scraping the barrel territory here? I mean, childcare is absolutely something that needs to be looked at, but I wouldn't suggest this is probably the way to go about it. Anything in there that was mooted that you thought, actually, there's something in that? Or did you just think this is like, what?
Well, two things there. Three things, really. Mm. I think this was actually a cabinet brainstorming thing where
clearly
people just brought some ideas. And I do think that you have to be fair to people in that scenario and say, well, if you've just been asked to bring some ideas and you've brought some ideas.
Wait, everything on the table. That's no criticism.
You can't be too critical of people. And I'm going to say this before I move into the next thing I was going to say.
Which is going to be critical.
Yeah, because I think it would be unfair if we started a weekly criticism of Grant Shapps bit of the podcast.
Okay.
And we were slightly critical of him last week with the Great British Rail sale. And it is Grant Shapps, the Transport Secretary, who came up with the MOT every 2 years. An idea that met with widespread derision from those in the motor industry, who said it's hard enough managing to make people keep their cars safe when they have to get them MOT'd once a year, let alone every 2 years, and exactly how much are you going to be saving people? Well, you're either saving people the cost of the MOT, which is about 50 quid a year, or are you doing it because you're saving the money on the repairs on their car? But they only have to have the repairs on their car if their car is not roadworthy.
Exactly.
So are you saying we're going to let people have unroadworthy cars for a little bit to help them out? Unsurprisingly, that idea went nowhere. Okay, the idea was brought in, it was put on the table. I believe the idea was taken swept off the table.
Yeah,
and next week we're not going to have a let's pick on Grant Shapps moment in the podcast. Okay, you never know what he could do between now
exactly.
and this week.
Okay? Never say never.
Look, I'm gonna be fair, I met Grant Shapps many years ago, and he was a very nice person.
He's wonderful.
And the thing that it was because I went on the BBC to talk about something, he was going on after me to talk about something, and I can't remember what it was to do with.
Was it a load of rubbish as well?
No, something to do. It might be something to do with passports or something. Something he'd done a lot of very detailed research into was telling me about, and I was like, actually, this is quite an important thing. So you know, let's be fair there. But
the MOT thing, because that's not going too well at the minute.
No good. Yeah, the MOT thing, no good.
No.
Childcare, though, on the other hand, actually, I do think there is an issue there. We do have a greater requirement for minimum numbers of staff per child compared to many other European countries. Their children seem to be largely okay. It's early years education, it gets referred to as nowadays. Our nursery costs are absolutely exorbitant. And our children then, fortunately, do then start proper school at an earlier point than children on the continent. Somehow we still manage to take them out of their education, not achieving anything more or any brighter or more intelligent than children on the continent. So I think maybe we could maybe relax it a little bit. And I know how expensive childcare is in this country for small children before they go to school. It is unbelievably expensive. Even with the 30 hours free childcare, the amount of other costs that the nurseries lump in. When my kids were in nursery, in a bog standard nursery in Finsbury Park, if you worked it out on an annual basis to have them there full time, it was more expensive than the average private school fee, which is completely mental.
Ridiculous.
My cousin, on the other hand, who lives in France, who I saw a few weeks back, her childcare hardly costs anything. Very, very affordable and very, very cheap. So I think there is definitely an issue there for families. There are families where one partner does not work because if they were working, they would be losing money because the childcare is of an order of magnitude more expensive than the money they would be getting in. So I do think childcare is an issue. I think there are lots of other things. I think the list of stuff that came out of that cabinet meeting illustrated quite how hard it is to solve this cost of living crisis problem, as we talked about last week with energy bills, short of just handing people money. But we decided to stop handing people money when we were trying to get out of the pandemic habit of handing people money. So I genuinely don't know what we're going to do.
I reckon, just a new idea here, windfall tax on energy firms. That one's making the rounds again.
That one is doing the rounds again. They are making a lot of money.
I don't actually necessarily agree with doing that. I just thought it was strange that having absolutely no, we're not going to do it, it now seems to be the thing that's again, making the rounds again. Is this likely?
The argument against that is twofold. One, you want them to continue to invest into their businesses in order to become more efficient and make energy cheaper, and particularly at the moment with the transition to green energy. That's very, very important. And the money that you take out of them in form of a windfall tax, ultimately there's going to be a knock-on effect where some of that doesn't go into the investment in the future. Secondly, you potentially end up hitting normal people because it reduces the dividends of some of these very big players, and most of us are invested in them in some way, a lot of us through our pensions, through tracker funds and things like that. That's one small argument. The other argument is that energy firms' profits are very cyclical. Sometimes when energy prices and oil prices are spiking, they are making money hand over fist, paying out huge dividends to shareholders. At other times, they're losing huge amounts of money. All of these companies lost a lot of money not very long ago when we were in the first year of COVID, before there was this price spike, when there was a price collapse. So I don't know. I mean, yes, maybe it's an idea if we need to take some money to give to some people to help them with their energy bills somewhere. But it's a bit rich, isn't it, to hear a government talking about a windfall tax on energy firms.
It's a funny conservative
who are coining
government
it in. Well, it's a bit rich when you remember quite how much money they take in VAT on petrol, which is charged on top of the fuel duty that they are already charging people. So if there's anyone making a windfall from this, well, not if there's anyone, but one of the parties with a windfall from this is the government itself. I mean, they could just give that money back to us, I suppose.
Right, yeah. But they don't seem that keen on that. Right, we're going to leave this to one side because, let's be honest, we will discuss it again. But this is an interesting one. The monthly ink deals that come with a very big catch. So HP is disabling printer cartridges over the internet if you cancel your subscription. Rather creepy, Simon. Tell us more.
Firstly, I should say, or ask the question perhaps, is there anybody listening to this podcast who thought printing stuff at home could not possibly get any worse?
What's wrong with printing stuff at home?
It's a miserable experience. You buy a printer, it never works properly. It refuses to connect properly to your computer, even though it's meant to connect via Bluetooth or a what. I mean, there's like multiple ways to connect the printer nowadays. Many of them don't work all at the same time. Then you finally do go to print something off. Oh, you've run out of ink. So you get some new ink cartridges, you put them in. Oh, you've run out of ink in the other cartridge, or there's some other problem. And then it just randomly won't print. Oh, and actually, sorry, it does 16 test pages and goes completely loop the loop in the middle. Doesn't it? So, and half the time when you want to print something, and oh yeah, and because you because we don't live in an office and we don't have enough space to permanently have a printer out, we have to put it into a cupboard. So in order to do all of this, you have to find it in the cupboard, plug it in, connect it to your computer, then you can't print what you need to print. Then you start WhatsApping people or texting them or phoning them, go, can I use your printer, please?
It's not a fan, Simon, not a fan, clearly.
Not a fan. They've
And HP have made it even worse now.
And HP have made it even worse. They've made it worse in a way of trying to make it better, because the way this system is built is that printers are sold cheaply. They're almost a disposable item. They have a very short shelf life.
For something so big, it is really quite cheap.
And they make all their money off the ink. They flog you the printer on the on the cheap, and then they make all their money off the ink. So the idea was that there would some way, the, you know, start to solve this problem. And so you got a subscription. The customers pay between 99p and £22.49 a month for HP's instant ink service. The printer is permanently online, so you can't just shove it in your cupboard. I don't know, maybe you can. Mm. And the cartridges can monitor the ink levels. When they're running low, new ones are automatically delivered to your door.
Smart printers, nice.
So there you go. You don't have that issue where, okay, I've got it out the cupboard. I've managed to finally get it to connect to the computer. I don't have any ink cartridges and so on and so on. But people are cancelling their subscriptions. And Epson and Brother also offer similar services, but HP's is by far the most popular with around 10 million subscribers worldwide, just to be clear. Other people are doing that. But there's a catch that's rarely made clear. I mean, rarely made clear is often just code for people didn't read stuff properly. I don't know where it falls within this. I know from my miserable experience of trying to print stuff at home that I'm on the customer's side here. Mm-hmm. Cancel your subscription, your cartridges get remotely disabled. They've still got ink in them, but you can't use them.
Wow.
I was having a conversation with someone about this. I cannot believe, I know it's a declining industry, printing stuff. Yeah. At home, I'm sure it's a declining industry.
Because I print a lot at home,
but
I do taxes and stuff.
Yeah, true. But there's a lot more opportunity to read stuff on a device nowadays, isn't there? You don't need to do as much printing at home as you would have done. You email your documents, all that kind of stuff. When I think, my mum runs her own business, right? She runs her own letting agency. When I think back to the amount of printing and paper that used to go on 20 years ago. 25 years ago in our house and what it's like now, still a reasonable amount, but it's nowhere near as much. But you'd think someone would have disrupted this, wouldn't you? You'd think someone would have gone, do you know what's a really miserable experience? Printing stuff at home. Why don't we provide a good experience for people? How about we make a printer that just works properly, and then we sell people the cartridges at a reasonable rate? Yeah. Job done. Nobody's really done
You need like an Amazon service, you know, like a 1 hour job or a 30 minute job. You just send them the stuff and boom, they're around with your papers.
I don't know how much that exists in the UK. I do know it's a thing in the US, the print shop thing. You end up paying a lot of money for it though. You can send your stuff through to somewhere and they'll print it and you can go pick it up. I had the idea for the Uber of home printing, where you had an app and you could go onto the app and see who's got a printer that's actually connected, has cartridges in it and can work. Yeah. And then you could say to them, you know, I'd like to book some printing on your printer, please. Which I guess is just the home version of the print shop. But I'm not sure there's enough money in it for it to take off, but it's a miserable experience. I think we'll all agree.
It is. But going back to creepy HP, what have they said about that? Is that okay just to stop? Because you're stuck with that one, right? You can't wait until it runs out and then you cancel, because they've already got one in the post for you ready.
I'm sorry. Are you trying to introduce an element of journalistic balance of reply into this conversation? what's wrong with you?
Sorry,
printers are evil. Get on board, Georgie.
All right. Screw you all.
HP says customers will be able to use their printer again if they purchase a regular cartridge. An HP spokesman says, cartridges delivered as part of an Instant Ink subscription will only work while a printer is enrolled in the HP Instant Ink service. If the subscription has been cancelled, customers can continue to use their printer with standard cartridges and return their Instant Ink supplies for recycling.
Shipping them or something? Or
yeah, that's what it'll be, won't it? It's the Internet of Things, isn't it? So remember, your fridge is going to do this soon. It'll order milk for you.
It's going to lock when I do the subscription service. Sorry, you can't eat anymore.
You've moved supermarket. You can't open your milk anymore.
Yeah, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, we've caught you shopping at Aldi. You're not opening that milk, love.
No tea for you. All right, then, you can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, and you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past. And if you've got any other weird examples of stuff like the HP Ink service story, send them in to us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. We will feature them on the podcast. Just make sure you stick podcast in the subject line, and then we'll be able to search them out.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
eToro is a social network.
No, eToro is an investment platform. Fly me
to the moon. It's both. That's social investing. In other words, it's where millions of people invest in stocks, share ideas, strategies, and beyond. eToro, the power of social investing. In other words, download eToro today from the App Store or Google Play. Your capital is at risk.